Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And Mark Bergen has written a book about the history of YouTube, which was billed as a page-turner. And it actually was. And the reason was, as I was reading it, Mark, it's pretty clear that YouTube was founded by, you know, a bunch of gung-ho techies who decided to maximize the time spent watching, and apparently never crosses their mind that this whole thing might get out of control. And this is one of the reasons that YouTube has found itself feverishly trying to moderate content. So first of all, where does the company stand now? Have they gotten a hold of some of the problems that that you document in the book?
I would say so. And part of that is because there were so many problems, and the real catalyst for change, and I talk about this in the book, is that YouTube is an advertising business. Its primary way of making money is that advertisers will, you know, give them money to run commercials, we see before and during the videos on YouTube. They really were responsive when advertisers staged boycotts over inappropriate and extremist videos. And then they've been responsive to now the threat and actual regulation that they faced and made. So the world of YouTube Kids is dramatically different than it was a few years ago. And the way YouTube here handles conspiracies and hate speech and online harassment are light years away from what they were 5 years ago. That being said, these problems are far from solved.
Would you say YouTube is safer today because of these checks and balances, or are we still in the wild west of the internet?
I think so. One person I talked to at the company compared it to cars before seatbelt laws. So I think that's an apt comparison. I think we are now entering the early stages of seatbelt laws. In some ways, it's sort of up to us as the viewer to like wear our seatbelt. And you can see that with like a lot of the kids programming on YouTube, right? The company has traditionally been like, this is a decision that we think that parents should be able to kind of have oversight of what their kids are watching. Despite the fact that we kind of know that a lot of kids are watching videos without their parents' involvement or impact.
That's absolutely true.
But yes, I think that is, it is still a massive global video service. You know, the stat they share, this is a few years old and it's probably small, but it's 500 hours are uploaded every minute, which is mind-boggling, the amount of content that is on the site, and that's continuing to be added.
I've never understood why the FCC doesn't regulate this. I know I've been overruled by society on this whole matter, but this is like Cairo sets up a transmitter on the top of a hill and turns it on and flips the switch and then opens a studio with live mics and says, hey, anybody come on in and say whatever you want without any editorial control. And YouTube, you know, and other online companies get a pass on this because they're just platforms. They're just passing it on. But they're not. They're now moderating content. They have to, because otherwise you have, you know, live beheadings and shootings on their channel. Why not admit that these services need some kind of regulation?
I'm not an expert on regulation. The thing I found really interesting here is around kids programming, where, you know, the FCC, as you mentioned, does regulate pretty aggressively, I think, television for kids. About, you have to have a certain amount of educational programming. You can't be overly promotional. You can't run too many ads relative to programming. There are child labor laws about the number of hours that the children can appear on screen. None of that exists on YouTube. But YouTube has been regulated around children's content, and arguably the only real, in the U.S. at least, serious regulatory action against a big tech company was when the Federal Trade Commission, which has oversight of these online platforms, fined YouTube for violating Children's Online Privacy Protection Act and collecting data on children under 13. And YouTube was forced to dramatically change the way its business operates and pay a lot more attention to kids content. YouTube is the biggest, world's biggest kids entertainment service by far. And you go look at the most popular videos on YouTube right now, they are all made for children under five.
Yeah. Well, in my 9-year-old, she recently got into YouTube for Minecraft instructional videos. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do see her applying those. You basically watch an adult play Minecraft, and they teach you how to build things and do things. And I see her apply those lessons when she's on the video game. But my concern isn't so much what is she going to see in this video, but why is it so addicting to the point where she can lose track of time? She doesn't hear me when I'm talking to her. They must know that there is a psychological reason behind this addiction. And what is that? And how do we call on a company to say, okay, but we have to get this under control. You're turning our kids into zombies.
There's a line in the book that someone at the company at one point said that it certainly felt like it was working at a tobacco company when the kids content started to appear.
Right.
I mean, I think the companies really struggle with this in part because, you know, their whole premise is they don't have gatekeepers, right? Like there's no one telling you, there's no producer or agent telling you this can or cannot be greenlit as a broadcast. And some of there's some of that beauty. Like I guess Minecraft is a really interesting example. Like there are sorts of forms of entertainment now that didn't exist 20 years ago. There's new types of, you know, YouTube has exposed people to different cultures and languages and given like a more diverse set of creators an audience than they otherwise would have on traditional media. That being said, like this clearly has some a very addictive appeal, and it like their machines are optimized since for the past decade. They've been optimized for watch time, is what they call it.
Yeah,
internally.
Talk about that, because I mean, we talk about addiction as a downside. Addiction is the point. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, some programming is healthier than others, but
yes,
that's the point.
When they made that decision, and the book goes into kind of detail about this, when they made the decision, YouTube was at that point, I think, around 5 to 7 minutes a day of sort of daily consumption. And they saw television was 4 to 5 hours. And so if you're sitting inside YouTube, you're thinking you're the tiny little underdog compared to TV. And their objective was we can compete with TV. And so they set a goal of getting 1 billion hours of watch time a day. And I think what I wanted to get across in the book is that, yes, they set this engine to sort of optimize for just watch time. And we're certainly naive about the unintended consequences of that. But from their perspective, like they are an underdog taking on traditional media.
Mark Bergen is the author of Like, Comment, and Subscribe. It's an inside look into YouTube's rise to power and influence, and it is quite a soap opera at times. Mark, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, Colleen, your daughter ignores you?
I know. It sounds very typical of a child to not hear their parents' voice, but it's different where you can stand right in front of them, and it's like, huh? Like, they really don't see
you. Can't you use your news voice to get her attention?
Oh, sure, I could. But then it would just start a fight. And it's like, Mom, why are you talking to me? Lately, she's been like, Mom, stop looking at me that way. And I'm like, this is just my face, honey. So we've entered that stage, right?
Come on, when you're playing Minecraft and watching out for creepers and doing the whole thing, yeah, of course she's not going to hear you.
I know,
creepers.
I know. Yeah. I'm balancing this idea that like Minecraft is supposed to teach kids how to code and set them up for like a computer science career, but also she can just lose hours of her life to these YouTube videos that suck her in. As he said, there's a reason why YouTube is addicting.
But then she'll be supporting you in your old age, right?
Hopefully.
Well, the good news is she really knows how to punch trees.
Yeah.
So that will come in handy when you're
doing some backyard,
you know.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington, an evergreen...
And our resident historian Felix Bedell joins us every Friday for All Over the Map, which is his quick look at the stories behind local places and things. And when Mount St. Helens erupted in May of 1980, 57 people died. The landscape was buried in ash. And now the Forest Service says some long-lost artifacts from the eruption are starting to show up.
Yeah, this is pretty amazing. This news comes from Matthew Maherder. He's an archaeologist for the Forest Service, and he's the Heritage Program Manager on the Gifford Pinchot National Forest. That's in southwest Washington.
Items are eroding out of the landscape around Mount St. Helens that were there pre-eruption. So the parking lot for the upper alpine climbing of Mount St. Helens is eroding out of the hill. We found logging equipment that's eroding out of hillsides, other items that are just there. The landscape started to give back up what it covered up in the 80s.
Now, after 42 years, the reason why these artifacts are revealing themselves now is pretty simple.
Just time and erosion, because it's all loose pumice and ash. And so as the weather takes place, especially things on slopes or these kind of steeper areas where erosion is more heavy, you're getting that kind of stuff coming out.
Now, the logging equipment isn't a big surprise. It, of course, belonged to Weyerhaeuser, and most of it was just sitting there empty when the mountain erupted on that otherwise quiet Sunday morning. And some rusty hulks have been visible for years on the South Coldwater Trail. But Matthew Maherder says there's at least one recently revealed item that relates to a specific person.
We maybe found an object associated with Jerry Martin, who was killed in the blast, and nothing had been found of him. But there's other things eroding around landscape. Some of them we still have to confirm.
Now, that name Jerry Martin might sound familiar to anyone who remembers the 1980 eruption. For me, he's up there with Harry Truman of Spirit Lake Lodge or David Johnson of the U.S. Geological Survey. He was in his mid-60s. Jerry Martin was a Navy vet, a ham radio guy from Skagit County who was part of a network of volunteer hams monitoring the mountain that spring. He'd parked his motorhome on a ridge about 8 miles north of the mountain. He could look south towards St. Helens and actually see David Johnston's trailer 2 miles away, 2 miles closer to the mountain there. And David Johnson of the USGS didn't survive, and unfortunately neither did Jerry Martin. But he did transmit a description of the eruption before he succumbed. Here's some final moments of Jerry Martin on the radio that morning.
Gentlemen,
so he's actually describing seeing David Johnston's observation post getting inundated by the eruption. The camper in the car sitting south of me is getting covered. It's going to hit me too. Now, about the artifact, Matthew Meherder says the Forest Service found a vehicle engine. It's emerging from the ash and pumice. He shared a photo. We have it at My Northwest. He says they're 98% sure that it's from Jerry's motorhome. So it's an otherwise ordinary object, big piece of metal, but it's the story attached to it is just amazing.
And it was 8 miles away.
Yeah.
And he still couldn't survive it.
Yep. All the ash and pumice and the hot cloud, the pyroclastic flow, all that stuff took those guys out. But in fact, he told people on the radio about it and it was recorded. Just powerful stuff.
Felix Bunnell, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. I expect you to be at the Guild 45th this morning, actually.
I was there yesterday. I was there yesterday. I took some pictures yesterday before they punched a hole in the side of the building there. But yeah, they tore down that little house about a week ago, and I've put pictures of that up there last week, too. So we've been living Guild 45th for many months in my household.
Felix Bunnell. 6:48, Seattle's Morning News, and this is it, the final morning commute without the West Seattle Bridge. It'll be back in operation on Sunday, but that's not the only construction project you need to be watching. Here's Chris Sullivan.
The repaired West Seattle Bridge has passed its final exam, and it will open sometime on Sunday, most likely early in the morning. This will end more than 900 days of unexpected exile for West Seattle residents and businesses. It took nearly 60 miles of steel cable, 100,000 square feet of carbon fiber ramping, and 240 gallons of epoxy to tighten the bridge and fill the cracks and to stop that aggressive concrete cracking that shut it down. Project manager Heather Marks says there won't be a staggered opening, which is one thing we thought they might do earlier to kind of test how the bridge was doing. They're going to open up all the lanes at once.
In the early days, we were thinking that might be the right way to go, but no, we're not going to approach it that way. We're just going to open the bridge. So I suspect it'll open up, early in the morning on Sunday, and people can resume their lives.
Mark says there's no way it could have worked, could have been done any faster to get this bridge back open. And she hopes that people have learned new and improved ways to get in and out of West Seattle during this 2.5 years of closure.
I hope that the long-term legacy for folks is that they understand that there are more ways to get off the peninsula than just in your single occupant vehicle. I also hope that by being transparent and every step of the way and keeping our promises within the bounds of possibility, that we build some trust with the community about SDOT's ability to do big things.
And Mark says there is no reason to doubt that the bridge will last another 40 years. To celebrate the reopening of the West Seattle Bridge, the Revive I-5 expansion joint repair project is going to end work early this weekend to make sure people can actually get it. Like the second place golfer tapping in to let the winner have the stage all to him or herself, Revive I-5 will stop work at 6 a.m. Sunday morning, so the reopening of the West Seattle Bridge will get the due that it deserves. Now, Revive I-5 will be working on the right side of the freeway from 6 p.m. tonight until 6 a.m. Sunday morning. Not as big of a closure as we've gotten used to, but there's a ton of other work we need to remember too, and I've been talking about it already this morning. 405 between Bellevue and Renton is going to be a mess. As we discussed earlier in the week, all lanes of 405 are going to be closed at Lake Washington Boulevard south of Factoria at 11 o'clock tonight, and that closure is going to last through 10 p.m. Saturday night. Workers are replacing the drainage system under the freeway and cutting a trench across all the lanes. North and southbound drivers will have to exit there at the construction zone, go through the intersection, and then back right on the freeway driveway on the on-ramp. Here's WashDOT's Carl Westby.
We need people to take alternate routes, stay home if possible, try and reschedule any important trips they have.
This could significantly impact your ability to get to and from the Husky game, which, of course, is one of the biggest events of the weekend. There's also work on westbound I-90 on the west edge of Mercer Island. West Mercer Way's on-ramp to westbound 90 is going to close at 10 a.m. this morning, and it's going to be closed all weekend long. So, Dave, you can't get off the island going that way. You'll have to go back into town and get back onto the freeway there.
Yeah, I encountered that this morning. That was kind of a surprise.
Yeah, and by the way, this is just the first phase of work, which will close all of westbound I-90 next weekend. I will dive into that in a choke point
next week. And what's the problem there? Is that another expansion joint?
Yeah, that goes all the way across the westbound lanes that also encompasses the on-ramp, which they're dealing with today and this weekend. So, hooray, you're going to have a lot of fun, and this is really going to impact the Seahawk game at home next weekend because I-90 is out of commission.
Yeah.
So start thinking about that.
Whatever it takes to keep that bridge floating, that's what I say.
Well, this one technically is on the shore of Mercer Island.
Yeah.
So technically, but it is elevated.
Isn't that what keeps it up? They just stretch a cable really hard on both ends just to keep that thing floating?
Pretty much that, and they've got a whole bunch of cables underneath they just finished replacing those this summer. That's what that giant crane's been doing in there, is they've attached them down at the bottom and replace those attachments.
Do they check those pontoons for leaks once in a while?
Oh, yeah. You better believe they do. That, you know, fool me once, shame on me, right? Or shame.
Wow. Anyway, so
too soon.
I know. Was it 1992?
Yeah, something like that.
So 240 gallons of epoxy?
Yeah. That's a lot of cracks they had to fill.
A lot of Bondo.
Yeah, just imagine with the guy there with the spackle and the knife, they're just cleaning those things out.
But from what I understand, not a single roll of duct tape was used.
I don't believe so. No, okay, I mean, I don't. Well, we can't say that for certain, but in terms of for maybe some things, but I don't think it was used to wrap the bridge.
No,
the carbon fiber, they stepped up a little bit from Gorilla Glue duct tape.
Oh, that stuff is pretty strong.
It is, but I'm not sure I would trust it, my life with it.
The political fight between Republicans and the Biden administration over immigration is heating up, with more busloads of asylum seekers arriving at various places, including yesterday the vice president's residence. Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan reminds us that this has been going on for weeks.
In fact, the mayor of Washington, D.C., Muriel Bowser, declared a state of emergency weeks ago. She had twice asked for help from the National Guard, and before that had talked to FEMA about getting federal resources to help these migrants who were being left in a city many of them apparently didn't intend to travel to, but were brought to on these buses. And so they were crowding into, for example, train stations here, places without adequate shelter. And it was overwhelming some of the shelter facilities that were here in the district. The bottom line being, if you're not a border city, you likely don't have facilities for those who've crossed the border. Some of those non-governmental organizations that are so key in Texas and Arizona, who set up stations to provide COVID testing and toothbrushes and the like. Now, these individuals who came on these buses have been processed. They are being, you know, processed into the federal system and claiming asylum. So these are not unknown individuals, but it is definitely being done to make a point. And of course, we are in election season, so everything's political.
Yeah. Some would characterize it as a threat. I think Donald Trump would characterize it as merely a heads up. But he was on the Hugh Hewitt show saying that, quote, there would be trouble if he was indicted. Trouble like you've never seen before. He uses that phrase a lot for just about everything, but it's getting some headlines today. Should we take that seriously?
I mean, he said, the former president, in this interview with conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt, that he can't imagine being indicted. And when Hugh Hewitt did say, you know, when you say the phrase, you'd have problems in the country, the likes of which we'd never seen before, the American people wouldn't stand for it, that was suggestive of a call to action. And the former president didn't go that far when he was pressed on that point. He said he was just saying his opinion. Now, of course, whether that's suggestive or not, or whether his followers are, effusive and passionate and therefore already have this sense of grievance and might act on it is another matter. But you know, at this point, we're not actually talking about indicting the former president when we look at the Justice Department investigation that is underway. That is not where that investigation is at this point in regard to the classified material taken from the former president's home, along with other materials. So both sides here are getting a little ahead of their skis. This is incredibly loaded. This is incredibly politically toxic, potentially. And so, you know, I think we all need to be pretty careful in our language on this one.
Yeah. And on the railroad strike, the agreement is tentative. I saw some clips today with an engineer saying, well, we still don't get our sick days. I still find it incredible they don't get sick days. But in any case, I mean, do we have any feel for whether it's going to be ratified by the unions or not?
Well, there's nothing thus far to suggest they won't. There was some, you know, cooling off timeline here to try to lower the temperature. And the date that was most focused on was this Monday potential shutdown that now has been averted, it would seem. And the administration is doing a victory lap here. So they seem to be pretty confident that while going to the brink, we were brought back from it. The concern here, of course, is this is also politically toxic. If you have a, you know, the Democrats in this administration has really embraced unions. So to have a economic, you know, problem caused by a shutdown due to unions striking would have been pretty politically awkward for the president and his allies, who really rushed in and tried to help hammer out some negotiation here. So the administration's doing a victory lap and saying they got directly involved and averted crisis. But this doesn't solve inflation. This doesn't bring down prices. It just stops things from getting immediately worse.
CBS's Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
Time for your daily dose of kindness. It is brought to you by Baird, focused on your financial needs since 1919. Visit BairdSeattle.com. A young reporter making her mark on the WNBA and fighting back against bullies. CBS's Jan Crawford has her story.
Thank you, Krista. I was able to talk to Las Vegas Aces head coach Becky Cavia.
When you hear Pepper Pursley reporting.
Hi, everybody. Pepper Pursley here.
My first question for you.
Asking questions of the WNBA's biggest stars.
How are you able to make adjustments from last game to today?
It's hard to believe she's 11 years old.
I am a kid, and I feel like I've been really lucky to have players open up to me.
That's my girl, Pepper!
Empowered women empower girls, mm-hmm. which I think definitely embodies the WNBA.
They're role models.
Yeah, they are role models, and so that's one thing that makes it super special for me.
Since she was a little girl, Pepper's parents, Christopher and Janelle, say she was a natural with questions.
So many questions.
Do you remember anything she would ask you when she was little?
Just about everything.
Everything.
Why does the moon do that? How do cars work? And, but I just remember her being so interested in the WNBA.
They were like, we didn't play in the WNBA. I don't know. You should ask them. And I was like, you know what? I will. I wanted to play in the WNBA. Like, that was my biggest goal.
A dream that became even more important a couple years later.
I was bullied in second grade. I thought that these girls were my friends, and they weren't.
They shared an awful message to her.
Which was what?
No one really likes you. You're too...
To everything.
You're to this, you're to that.
It was a really hard experience for me, but I was really proud of how I was able to, like, turn it on its head, and I really was able to connect with a lot of the WNBA players.
I was more so bullied when I was younger, around your age.
The players helped her launch an anti-bullying project.
That started her just really standing up for what's right for her.
I'm just lucky to be able to see myself in them.
By seeing yourself in them, what does that do for you as a girl?
It empowers me to believe in myself and to believe in my dreams and to not try to find a reason to stop, but try to find a reason to keep going.
Perfect message heading into the weekend.
7:49, here he is from the Gene Ursula Show, G. Scott, Seahawks in first place.
Woo!
Going into week two, and they're up against the 49ers. And how serious is losing Jamal Adams?
It's serious. I mean, Jamal Adams is a focal point of that defense. The defense is kind of built around he and a few others on that team. So it is a big deal. He's going to be out for the season. He had a quad injury, and it's really a bummer for him. And the one thing that I want to say, because I've seen some awful things on Twitter where they said, oh, we should have never traded for him, and oh, he's always getting hurt. And, you know, no matter how much your bills are paid, life can still hit you. No matter how much money you got in the bank, life can still hit you. And I know sometimes that people think that, well, these athletes are fine. You know, they're good. They got enough money. No, they hurt just like you and I do. And so I really feel sorry for him because he didn't finish the season last season, season before. And it's been a rough break. And then you have that, okay, he's out for the season. Like, okay, well, you know what? You can just come back. Sometimes I've learned in the past that some of these athletes, they've gotten hurt so many times. And then the whole, like, okay, get this surgery. And then here's going to be your rehab for the next 6-7 months. And let me ask you this. Have you guys ever known someone to be like, no, I don't want to rehab. I don't want to do physical therapy. Mm-hmm. Let me just, I can't do it anymore. And so sometimes, I'm not saying Jamal is there, but I'm saying sometimes they get to that point. So anyways, as far as the next person up is going to be Josh Jones. He is a safety for the Seahawks, and he'll probably be starting alongside Quandre Diggs. Here's the good news that I can give you on the heels of the kind of that bad news with Jamal Adams. Josh Jones is really good. So good that even during the game Monday night before Jamal Adams got hurt, there were sequences in which Josh Jones, he would come in and they would move Jamal Adams over to linebacker and then they would have him in. So even before Jamal Adams got hurt, this new guy, Josh Jones, is coming in and he's really doing his thing. So I think the defense is going to be okay. I hope it is. They're traveling down to San Francisco, the San Francisco 49ers. Yes, they are still a rival. Okay. This is still a quarterback now. Trey Lance. So Trey Lance is the quarterback that they had drafted the year before while they still had Jimmy Garoppolo. Jimmy Garoppolo is still there as well. You would think that they would have said, okay, we have our quarterback in the future. Jimmy Garoppolo, you have to go. Well, Jimmy Garoppolo is still on the roster, and some say that that's because maybe the Niners aren't really too sure about the relationship with Trey Lance. So basically, in layman's terms, Jimmy Garoppolo is the ex that stays in the current's DMs and says, hey, everything's still going okay?
So he would vie for that quarterback spot, too.
Absolutely.
Okay. Got it. Are they good, the 49ers, or are we going to beat them?
I mean, they just lost to the Bears on the road. I'll answer that two ways. All NFL teams are good. That's one. And two, this is going to be a very hungry Niners team. It's their home opener. Right. It's a game in which, like, they as a team, they don't want to drop 0-2. Right. So I think it's going to be a tough game for the Seahawks. And let's just see what happens. The Seahawks are going on the road for the first time. This is the first time the Seahawks are going on the road without the leadership that they've had in the past. I think this Sunday is going to be a tough game for the Seahawks.
How's Geno feeling after all the support and love he got from the Monday Night Football
game? Well, you know, it's interesting because he got a lot of support and love after he won, but before he won, he did not.
Right.
So
right.
According to Geno, he said there were a lot of people that wrote him off, but he didn't write back. Quote, bar from Geno Smith.
All right.
Now, would you like to turn those sentiments into, let's say, a score?
Oh, yeah. Dave loves to do this.
Fam, why you got the pin out?
Does he like score predictions?
Come on.
I'm
going
to write it down. I want to get it right.
All
right,
bring the receipts.
At first, can you give me love by saying the Seahawks were going to win on Monday night? Can you give me that love? All right, cool.
It.
Yeah. All right. Oh, boy. Man, I think it's going to be a low-scoring game.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the score is going to be, I think it's going to be 20-19.
Ooh, another one-point game.
Yeah,
huh?
20-19.
Right, edge of our seats.
And you think the Hawks will be on the 20 side?
I mean, I have to say that.
To say that.
But there are doubts.
No, it's not doubts. It's gonna
that
be
was a doubt.
It's
going to
be a tough game.
To
I'm
it.
Putting an asterisk
look,
on that.
Look, sometimes, you know, you're going to ask them out. This is your time. You're going to ask them out. You have confidence, but there's a little bit of doubt.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Everything's a dating analogy.
Yeah. You ever slid in somebody's DMs, Dave?
I don't even know what that means, but I'll ask Colleen during this spot.
I hope he hasn't.
Dave, if you were to slide into DMs, what would you say?
I'm coming home with eggs and bacon.
Wow, what's that slang for? Ooh.
Eggs and bacon.
You can ring my bell. Rachel Bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And here's Rachel Bell. It turns out our city once again is setting the pace when it comes to not coming into work.
Yes. But still working, but in the home.
Right.
So, of course, a lot of people started working from home when the pandemic started, but there's only one other city in the United States that has more people working from home than we do. So we are number two in the nation for work from homers. 47% of Seattleites are working from home. The 47%.
Then why is traffic still horrible?
That's what I was wondering too. Washington, D.C. is the only city that has more people working from home, and it's just the slightest 1% up. They're at 48%. San Francisco is number three. And if it feels like everyone's working from home everywhere, that's not true. There are places in the country where, for example, 9% of people in Wichita, Kansas are working from home. In El Paso, Texas, and in Memphis, Tennessee, only 10% of people. And it said 60% of American jobs cannot be done from home. Mm-hmm. So there's so many people who need to go into work. But of course, we have so many tech workers. So according to the Pew Research Center data, they said people who have a four-year college degree are the most likely to work from home. Upper income professionals. So, yeah, things we already knew, but I just
think the answer to Colleen's question, though, is that because if you looked at the stats there, the bulk of the people who are no longer coming in the city were taking transit. So the people who drive cars are the ones who are going back to the office.
Those are the ones who still have to work in the office. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Because my husband is now working from home permanently post pandemic. They had the option pre pandemic where it's like, yeah, if on Thursdays and Tuesdays you guys want to work from home, that's your choice. But now it's, you know, Monday through Friday. And what we're noticing is the arches of his feet are starting to hurt more when he exercises. Mm. He's gaining more weight. It's okay that I talk about this. We're not too sensitive about this. You know, the social aspect of going into the office.
Why does he go back then?
Because it's more convenient for families to have a parent at home. He has to get the girls ready for school in the morning. You know, he's there.
And his shoes don't fit anymore.
If we have any home repairs, he's there in case somebody needs to come by. But I think we're going to start seeing long-term health effects from working from home.
Post-pandemic,
right? We're noticing it just in this little microcosm of our home.
I have to say, I really enjoyed working from home. But since I've been back in, we just started allowing guests back in the building to have people come in for interviews. And a couple weeks ago was my first time. I had three people in 1 week. I just like loaded it up. And it made such a difference, not only in the quality of the interview, both sound and the discussion, but with one of the women, I mean, we ended up chatting for 30 minutes before the interview even began. It gave me story ideas to work on for other things. Mm-hmm. We connected in a way that I know she wouldn't have been as open in the interview if we didn't bond beforehand. Right. And we actually went and had drinks last week. And she's my friend now.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
We would never have become friends if she hadn't come in. Because if it was on Zoom, we would have just started, done the interview, and logged off. So I really do believe that there is a lot to be gained from being in person, maybe not for every job, but I do also understand the benefits of being at home. I think that's the hard part is, you know, a lot of people do want to be at home, but realize that they can't really do their job quite as well.
Yeah.
And the other feel-good story is that according to the New York Times, you should ask people for help because people want to help others.
There's all kinds of reasons that people don't like to ask for help. Even, you know, can you come and feed my cat this weekend? Little things like that. People are afraid of imposing. They're afraid of rejection. According to this article, the pull yourself up by your bootstraps mythology so ingrained in American culture, like I have to do everything myself. Mm-hmm. But what they did in this study was published in the Journal of Psychological Science this month. They did six small experiments involving more than 2,000 participants. And across the board, people were so surprised, first of all, how willing people were to help, but the people who helped said, no, this made me feel really good. I'm so happy I got to help. And some of the experiments were really, really tiny. It was asking someone to take a picture of you, you know, as they walked by. People do that all the time, but you know, you do kind of feel that asking someone even in that situation. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's all kinds of mental and physical benefits to helping people. They call it the helper's high. I think it also increases bonding and community because in the way that we live these days, not everyone even knows their neighbors. People like myself who live by myself, we kind of do things on our own. And so it just feels good when you start asking to know that there are people there for you if you need it and you can help them. It just makes you feel more connected to your neighbors if that's who you're asking for help.
That's why I always carry jumper cables.
You do?
So that just in case someone says, you know, I see a stolen car, I can come with my. Because they're really convenient. You have this little battery. The battery's, you know, like the size of a little paperback.
So oh, yeah. Like a trickle one?
Yeah. And you can say, I can start your car up.
And it feels good.
There's no better feeling than being equipped to help as well.
It's so true. It's so true. I think I talked about this on the show. I got really into chopping wood. I was gifted a hatchet and it just really empowered me.
You can split wood.
I split wood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you busy this weekend?
No, I'll clear my schedule. I'd love to
this
help.
Is a wood chipper thing again,
Dave. I want
Dave.
The helper
He's always
high.
Chipping wood. No, I don't.
I have some rather large rounds of a dead maple tree that need to be split.
Rachel, I can help you.
You just got invited to Dave's house.
You should see me. I bring it over my head.
Yes.
And then
that's
I go, kapow.
That's
and
what
then
it's
it goes, and it splits in two.
Yes.
And then I feel great.
Yes.
Look yeah.
All right. Well, we'll talk.
All right.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.